Prelude. Detective Comics number 273, cover dated November 1959. Gasps of astonishment go up as city citizens gaze upon an unearthly missile overhead. The strange craft lands in a nearby park from which a jaundiced extraterrestrial exited. A crowd gathered nearby, taking cover behind a statue. Is he friendly or dangerous? Approach him carefully. Caution proved the better part of valor as the yellow-skinned Martian drew a ray gun that vaporized the statue with one shot.
Out of my way, Earth people!
As the humans evacuated the scene, Brett thought to himself,
Look at them flee! With my Martian powers, I'll become the most powerful man on Earth!
Immediately, the alien newcomer began a reign of crime. Recognizing Earth people stored their money in banks, Brett used
one of my Martian talents
to pass immaterially through a vault wall to help himself. Confronted by armed guards, he chided,
Guns? You think you can stop me with your puny guns? Come to think of it, who needs money? I can take anything I want from you helpless Earthlings.
Minutes later, Captain Harding summoned Ace Detective John Jones to his office.
Jones, hundreds of calls are pouring in about an alien on Earth.
Jones promised to look into it while wondering
what the chief would have said if he knew that I'm an alien. Still, I doubt there's another outer spaceman on Earth.
However, Detective Jones soon found himself in a crowd watching Brett plow through heavy traffic with his super breath.
Great suns, it's true.
The super sleuth noticed Brett was warning people not to follow him, rather than simply turning invisible.
As any Martian can do.
Only through his Martian eyesight could Jones follow the evil alien's sudden burst of speed, leading to an abandoned warehouse. Jones followed Brett into the warehouse before undergoing his startling change into Jean Jones, the manhunter from Mars. Brett exclaimed,
Thunder and meteors! Another Martian? How did you get here?
Jones played it tough, demanding,
Suppose you tell me who you are and how you got here.
My name is Brett. I had to leave Mars in a hurry, so I hit myself in an experimental missile that overshot its mark and accidentally landed on Earth.
The Martian Manhunter wasn't buying it.
A criminal, huh? Well, I'm returning you to your missile.
Brett was no more interested in Jean's line and drew his Martian gun.
I may be invulnerable to Earth weapons, but that gadget can finish me for good.
The alien Atlas turned himself invisible as the Martian criminal used his gun's battery firing blind. Brett had
plenty more
batteries at the missile.
Meanwhile, I've got another weapon I can use against you.
The Martian Marvel was shocked at the sight of
a pellet of Formula Z6, a chemical given to Martian criminals to rob them of their superpowers while invisible. No wonder you never vanish.
Jean Jones collapsed from exposure to the gas, though he remained obscured.
Exactly. And from now on, you will never be able to use your Martian powers while invisible either.
Brett had escaped his missile by the time Jones regained consciousness and resumed the chase. As Brett exited the craft with his recharged ray gun, he was met by three police officers in over their heads.
I can't use my powers to save them, unless I become visible and give away my presence on Earth. I have no choice.
The police were rattled by the sudden appearance of two Martians, but the sleuth from outer space assured,
Have no fear of me. I am on Earth to fight crime.
Brett dismissed.
Bah! Take one more step, Manhunter, and I'll start blasting.
Jean knew.
He means it.
And used his Martian distance vision to detect a man burning leaves miles away. The Manhunter filled his Martian lungs, then let loose a mighty blast that blew in the burning leaves and encircled Brett.
Fire! The one Martian weakness! I'm losing all my strength! Oh!
Jean announced,
Now's your chance, officers. Grab him. I don't dare come any closer to that fire.
Helpless, the evil Martian is placed back in his missile, and soon after, at a nearby rocket launching base, he was shot in orbit around Mars at the Manhunter's request.
So the Martians will then be able to send up a ship and bring him down.
Just after liftoff, the familiar voice of Captain Harding greeted the once secret visitor from Mars. As he shook Jones's hand, Harding considered,
Imagine, a Martian Manhunter, here on Earth. Would I love to have you on the force?
Though he was intent on continuing to keep his Earth identity secret from even the chief, Jones promised,
I will always be available for emergencies.
Later at headquarters, Harding continued to brag to,
Jones, until today you are the top detective in town. But from now on, you'll have to take second place to the Manhunter from Mars.
The unmasking of Jean Jones was by Jack Miller and Joe Serta.
A podcast for Jean Jones. The Manhunter from Mars, his world, and the vile menagerie of villains he must confront.
In the past, overzealous comic historians tried to peg the Martian Manhunter as the first superhero of the Silver Age of comics. While it is true that Detective Comics number 225 predated Showcase number 4 by about 3/4 of a year, the fact is that Jean Jones wasn't a superhero yet. Jean Jones was an alien visitor stranded on Earth, who quickly shapeshifted into the form of a human being, and then took on the job of a cop. And so basically, he looked like a human. He dressed like a detective. And he just happened to use his Martian powers to defeat usually standard issue criminals. On the occasions when John Jones actually appeared as a green-skinned Martian, he was virtually always invisible. So the readers could see that this was a Martian affecting events in this metropolitan city he worked out of, but nobody else could. And it's also true that even in the earliest strips, John Jones occasionally faced criminal scientists and clandestine aliens, but the public wasn't aware of those characters, and they didn't look particularly super compared to what had been in the comic books of old, and would return again with the arrival of The Flash, and not too terribly long thereafter, Green Lantern. What you could argue as the first costumed super foe didn't turn up until Detective Comics number 263, cover dated January 1959. This fellow was the Conjurer, but to call him a supervillain would probably be taking it too far. He ran around in purple formal attire, he was a magician, and he used gimmick traps to distract police, but it's very basic silly stuff that the toy man would have scoffed at. Really, the first proper supervillain to appear in the strip was the Fantastic Human Falcon a few months later. This is a guy who had a cape, he wore a bird mask, he flew around in a Falcon aircraft, much closer to what you would imagine from a comic book antagonist. But even still, the Human Falcon thought that he was dealing with a plainclothes policeman. Any cool Martian stuff tended to happen with the titular character Invisible. However, 3 months ahead of the debut of the Justice League of America, the yellow-skinned Martian Brett was the first publicly known space invader in the comic strip. Brett, of course, forced the Martian Manhunter to reveal himself to the city he had been defending. Since exposure to Formula Z6 had rendered the Martian Manhunter incapable of turning invisible and then using any of his other powers. And there's really no point in doing that anymore because the public knew that he was around now. And also, while descriptive text had used the term Martian Manhunter, this was the first time in the strip that other characters knew that there was such a thing as a Martian Manhunter and referred to the Manhunter from Mars as such. So the unmasking of John Jones is his true debut as a superhero. And then the following month, he got his second supervillain, the Human Flame. And just 1 month ahead of the debut of the Justice League, we had the reintroduction of the character who would most qualify as John Jones' Lois Lane, Patrolwoman Diane Mead. Plus, the month after his joining the Justice League of America, his third supervillain made his debut, Mr. Moth, who was suspiciously similar to the Human Falcon, except moth-themed. But all this talk is just to provide context for our main topic this episode.
In 1994, Mark Waid, Brian Augustine, and Barry Kitson began exploring the beginnings of the world's greatest superhero team over an epic 12-issue comic maxi series. And yes, we've just begun. That team was the Justice League of America, and that comic was JLA Year One. In 2016, 8 podcasts will come together to cover this series in a single month. That month is JL May. Featuring the Fire and Water Podcast, The Power of Fishnets, Waiting for Doom, The Lantern Cast, Supermates Podcast, The Idlehead of Diabolu, Comic Reflections, and Views from the Long Box. Each podcast will cover one or two issues of JLA Year One, and then coverage will move from show to show. It all starts in the Fire and Water Podcast with issues 1 and 2. Yes, we've just begun. JL May, an epic month for an epic series. Available where you find all good podcasts.
The Brave and the Bold, number 28, which according to Mike's Amazing World of DC Comics, came out December 29th, 1959, and introduced the Justice League of America, which I submit was the quintet of Wonder Woman, the Martian Manhunter, Green Lantern, The Flash, Aquaman. Martian Manhunter enters the story on page 5, where it's explained that he's going to join the Justice League for an adventure while he's on a vacation from his job as policeman John Jones. He then partners with Wonder Woman to battle Starro. Now, admittedly, the Magnificent Seven appear on the splash page to the story Starro the Conqueror, and Superman is even introduced into the story before Martian Manhunter on the second story page. However, Superman's only in 2 panels, and those panels are used to explain why he's not going to take part in this Justice League adventure after receiving a call on their signal device. On the next page, Batman appears in 2 panels, where he's driving around in Gotham City in the Batmobile, chasing after 2 unnamed archenemies, and he basically decides, hey, I'm going to do this. Unless they absolutely need me, I'm not going to show up to this Justice League thing. The truth is that Superman editor Mort Weisinger and Batman editor Jack Schiff didn't want to see their main characters, Superman and Batman, diluted by association with another franchise that they didn't have editorial stewardship over and would receive no credit for the success of said strip. So while Batman and Superman were featured in ads, they weren't allowed on any of the Justice League covers in the early days. In the very first adventure, they're non-participants who just have cameos in which they blow off the team. Batman had a smallish role in the second Justice League story, while Superman showed up at the end to help wrap up the case of the Challenge of the Weapons Master. In the Justice League's third adventure with Amazo, Superman and Batman disappeared off on errands that apparently had nothing to do with the core adventure after the group had had a meeting to discuss how they were going to deal with Professor Ivo. It wasn't until the fourth Justice League adventure that Superman and Batman were full participants, but for most of the early stories thereafter, they were just in glorified cameos. The World's Finest Duo skipped issues 6 and 8 altogether, and aside from the tiny chess pieces seen on the cover of Justice League of America number 1, they didn't appear on any covers until number 10, and then not again until number 19. You don't see Batman and Superman regularly appearing on covers until 1964. So it was actually a bit odd that 3 years after the introduction of the Justice League, we finally got their origin story in Justice League of America number 9, cover dated February 1962, but released on December 21st, 1961.
The Justice League of America, the combined might and power of the Man of Steel and the Cosmic Crusader, the Winged Avenger and the King of the Sea, the Tiny Titan, and the Scarlet Streak, all working together for good against evil as the Justice League of America.
How did the Justice League of America come into being? What was a strange menace which united them? Where did this menace come from? When did the champions of justice discover that the one weapon which would help them triumph over the menace was teamwork? The answer to these questions are revealed for the first time in The Origin of the Justice League, written by Gardner F. Fox, penciled by Mike Sikowski, inked by Bernard Sachs, and edited by Julius Schwartz. The heroes of the Justice League are at their secret sanctuary, tidying up the place in advance of a birthday party. Teenaged honorary member Snapper Carr was pitching in. As he looked over a trophy case, wondered why they were keeping a collection of wood splinters and shavings. Everybody sat down at the meeting table, birthday cake was served, and John Jones began the story.
It was just 3 years ago today that the Justice League began. I feel I ought to begin, because I was the first one of us to learn about the strange menace, which was to unite us as a team for the very first time. Now remember, at the time of which I speak, there was no Justice League of America. In my secret civilian identity as a police detective, I heard a queer report from a patrol car in an outlying district.
Emergency alert! People all around us have been turned to stone!
Suddenly, the squad car radio man stopped talking. It was easy to visualize that the same fate had struck him. Believing that I could accomplish more as the Martian Manhunter, I switched my true self, John Jones.
I'll use my unique Martian powers to speed to the scene of the trouble without delay.
Below me, I saw men and women frozen in solid stone.
Even my Martian body is beginning to feel queer tingles from whatever force it is that altered the bodies of these people.
Using every bit of my superpowers, I fought off those tingles, and then...
A stone giant coming this way. Those blue beams from his eyes must be what caused everyone to become stony.
At full speed, I hurtled forward, my fist driving hard against his chest.
This ought to pulverize him.
To my utter amazement, I bounced off that massive chest, narrowly averting the full force of the giant's blue eye beams and the huge hands that sought to seize me. In the hope of learning his weakness, I trained my Martian vision on the stony creature's forehead and discovered I could read his thoughts.
The Stone Man is only one of a number of alien beings who have come to Earth in meteors from a planet he calls Apalax.
The ruler of Apalax had died, and according to custom, several claimants to the throne had come forward, among them the Stone Man. It was decided that the claimants would travel to the planet Earth, since this was the closest planet to Apalax, with conditions to support their kind of life, and which had never been used. Each of these warrior chieftains was condensed and sized and placed inside a meteor-type vessel to be hurled toward our planet. These meteors would safely withstand the hazardous voyage through hyperspace. Their plan was to divide Earth into 7 zones, over which each of the claimants would gain full and complete rule. As each meteor landed, the occupant would break its shell and emerge in its true form. Then, with its special powers, it would turn the inhabitants of Earth to life forms similar to its own. Commanding the army of these transmuted creatures, each would wage all-out war with one another, until only one remained. No sooner had I understood all this than I realized to my horror that just as I had read the stone giant's mind, so he had read my mind.
I've got to stop him before he can start a fire. Fortunately, I now know his weakness.
However, before I could make contact, a shower of sparks fell onto a sawdust pile in a nearby lumber yard. And
too late. Those flames are weakening me, sapping me of all my strength.
I barely managed to land near a fire hydrant where
dizzy, weak. I've got to keep on fighting.
As I twisted loose the hydrant valve, a stream of water shot out, and with my last remaining strength, I used my Martian breath to control it. The water spray hit the blazing sawdust full force, extinguishing the flames, restoring my great powers.
Just in time. Now to get at the stone giant's weakness.
Straight upward I leaped, aiming both fists for a spot on the temple of the alien creature.
I learned the exact spot on his temple where his weak spot is located while probing his mind.
I struck with the destructive fury of a dozen hurricanes. The stone giant crashed to the ground, knocked unconscious. As he did so, the people who he had turned to stone were instantly freed from his awesome spell.
Now to summon the police to take the giant into custody.
When the police arrived, I instructed them on what to do if the alien stirred.
Thanks, John Jones. We'll use sledgehammers on him.
Learning from the police where the other meteors had landed, I set out for the one that had fallen on the Carolina coast near Cape Hatteras.
This is the only meteor from which the alien being from Apalax has not yet emerged. Maybe I'll have time to overcome it.
And then, even as I ran toward the meteor, it began to pulse. Caught by surprise, before I could use my Martian powers to fight it, I felt myself turning into wood.
I'm helpless. I can't move.
As covered in a recent episode of the Secret Origins podcast, number 32, this origin of the Justice League was revised in 1988. In that version, the Apalaxians were a fairly homogeneous race of white-skinned beings who merely transplanted their consciousness into elemental warrior bodies, whereas in the original origin story, the Apalaxians were those bodies. This explains why in the revised story, our heroes are much more cavalier about acts of violence against the aliens. Specifically, once John Jones knows that the stone giant isn't a living being unto itself, he just flies right at it and blows apart the top half of its body. Otherwise, though, this was fairly similar between the two versions of the story.
Aquaman and Firestorm, fighting crime together. Soak them down or burn them up, no one does it better. Whenever you find trouble, they'll always be there to catch them in a bubble or even torch their hair. Stand for truth and justice in sea, on land, and
Fire and Water Podcast, celebrating Aquaman, King of the Seven Seas, and Firestorm, the Nuclear Man.
Available weekly on Aquaman Shrine, Firestorm Fan, and on iTunes and Stitcher.
I'm one of your hosts, the Irredeemable Shag, here to talk about Firestorm. Along with me is my co-host Rob Kelly, here to talk about some guy that talks to fish.
Really? You're going to pull this crap during the promo? Bad enough, I have to put up with your shenanigans every week, but...
The next hero in the original Justice League origin was Aquaman, who was warned of the arrival of the Apalaxian meteor by fleeing sea life, and specifically a dialogue with his finny friend, the Dorado. The Sea King confronted the glass Apalaxian in the Indian Ocean. After being turned into a glass statue and several failed attempts to control fish to do different things against the glass Apalaxian, Aquaman conjured up a school of drumfish, which emitted shattering sonic vibrations that destroyed the alien. And then in the final panel, Aquaman skied on dolphins to the Carolina meteor and was turned into a tree. The next meteor landed on a beach on Paradise Island, which was also pelted with queer radiation. I actually saw queer radiation at Pride Fair 2013, but trying to replace Melissa Etheridge with Michelle Indegiocello just didn't work. Queer radiation is only truly great with the original lineup. Suffering Sappho, back to the story. Princess Diana saved her fellow Amazons from being turned into mercury by lassoing that Apalaxian and swinging it so fast it became vapor. Luckily, Amazons are notoriously averse to pregnancy, so their inhalation of poisonous mercury vapor only cost them the sensation in their fingertips and gave them that pink-tinged complexion that was so common in the Silver Age. And then in the final panel, Wonder Woman flew her invisible plane to the Carolina meteor and was turned into a tree. Now, in the revised origin, it was Black Canary who was the third leaguer, and she fought the glass Apalaxian instead of the mercury one so she could shatter it with her canary cry. Again, slightly more violent in the 1988 story. And in that version, it was Aquaman who fought the mercury Apalaxian, which ultimately makes more sense because we're choking the life out of the ocean with pollution. So next up, a meteor flew past Green Lantern in outer space, and Hal Jordan followed it to the African continent in southern Rhodesia. That Appalachian turned Congo Bill and his life partner into freaky banana-colored man-bird things and began to transform Green Lantern. But he had time enough to lure the Appalachian bird creature into a waterfall and then froze the water. As soon as the Appalachian was defeated, everybody returned to normal. And then in the final panel, Green Lantern flew to the Carolina meteor and was turned into a tree. I swear, this is turning out to be like the worst choose-your-own-adventure book ever. Barry Allen was in Europe as the U.S. representative to Interpol when a meteor hit the Lombardy plain near Lake Como in northern Italy. The Flash raced to investigate and started turning into a fire being, but his constant vibration was able to counter that effect. The Scarlet Speedster tried several methods to snuff out the flame Appalachian before finally creating a vacuum of centrifugal force around it, tapping the alien out and returning everybody to normal. And then in the final panel, the Flash raced through the Carolina meteor and was turned into a tree. Now, between the Silver Age and the post-crisis versions of the story, the Flash and Green Lantern plots are virtually identical, except for the page counts. See, in the original story, Aquaman got 3 pages, Wonder Woman 3 pages, Green Lantern 3 pages. The Flash only got 2 2/3 pages because they wanted to throw in an ad, and he's a Flash, he can do things quickly. Whereas the Martian Manhunter actually got 5 pages in both versions of the story, probably because he was carrying most of the exposition that set up the Appalachians. Whereas in the revised version of the story, each member of the Justice League got 5 pages. And the setup for the Appalachians was a whole separate segment of the tale. Anyway, somewhat comedically, at the end of each chapter, Mike Sikowski had to draw and redraw the accumulating members of what would become the Justice League falling before the tree creature. And then we moved on to the tree Appalachian leading the future Justice League members on a trek to go after the final Appalachian that he's going to fight in order to become the King, Sovereign, whatever they called it. In the original version of the story, Aquaman was able to bump into Martian Manhunter, who in turn managed to scrape off the tree coating on Green Lantern's power ring. Manhunter then got blasted in the face with Emerald Energy, which freed his head, enabling him to use his powerful Martian breath to blow the Flash into Wonder Woman. Wonder Woman then half fell into Green Lantern's light and became bifurcated. Half her was wood and half of her was flesh. Luckily, the half that was flesh was in contact with the Lasso of Truth, which was soon slung around the wooden Appalachian and spun the creature so fast it turned into toothpicks. The superheroes were returned to normal, and the first words out of Flash's mouth were the extraordinarily patronizing, "Good girl, Wonder Woman," like she was a dog or something. Now, in the 1988 revision of The Secret Origin, it was Aquaman who bumped into Martian Manhunter, who bumped into Green Lantern's ring finger, which then zapped Black Canary's head. She used her canary cry to blast the Flash, who was already trying to vibrate out of the wood. And the Flash raced up and used his bare hands to turn the tree into splinters, and in turn, his hands were all chewed up by the wood. Now, the good thing about the revised version is that in the original story, the Flash is really nothing but a block of wood. He doesn't contribute anything to the resolution of the story. So he goes from being the most useless member in the Silver Age version to the most useful member in the revised version. Unfortunately, then the Martian Manhunter is replaced as a blunt object who just bumps into somebody. Now, what I'm thinking is, why not have the Flash use a free arm to do a swift surgical release of Black Canary's head and vocal cords, and then Canary could blast the tree into splinters. See, one of the cool things about the original Secret Origin is that it's Wonder Woman who defeats the Appalachian who defeated the other 4 members of her team. So it's a great feminist moment, and it's not hurt by the fact that she was also the most famous of the members present. So one of the nice things about Black Canary replacing Wonder Woman in the post-crisis version of the origin was that another woman got in there and would have had an opportunity to show off. But 1 step forward, 2 steps back, in replacing Wonder Woman with Black Canary, they decided they needed to have Flash step up and be the one who saves the day. A counter-argument would be, though, that that's kind of samey-samey. Black Canary just blasted the glass Appalachian, didn't require much in the way of thought, and then she turns around and blasts the wooden one. I can see where they'd want to get the Flash in there instead. Both the 1959 and 1988 version of the story resolve the Appalachian threat in just 2 pages, actually slightly less than 2 pages. In the case of the original versions, they had to fit in an ad. In that story, Superman and Batman are going up against a diamond being in the frozen Arctic. Unfortunately, this meteor was made up of kryptonite. Superman goes down. Batman, who never comes out of the Batplane during the action, flies by and skyhooks the meteor, restores Superman's power, who then, and there's a literal quote, "rubbed the diamond being the wrong way, back into coal." Meanwhile, in the 1988 Secret Origins revision, Superman beat the alien off, panel, and flew away without even noticing the JLA were en route. On the final page of the original story, Batman comes out of his plane to suggest, "We ought to form a club or society." Flash continued, "A league against evil. Our purpose will be to uphold justice against whatever danger threatens it." Back in the present, as everybody's finishing up their cake and good girl Wonder Woman is collecting all their plates, notes, "We returned such meteor beings as we could to their own world, keeping the pile of splinters as a souvenir." Instead of, like, burning the remains of the Appalachian or giving it back to its people to tend to the remains as they so choose. They kept a bunch of splinters as a souvenir. Real creepy. That also means that Wonder Woman killed two sentient beings, Aquaman one, and Superman one more. Apparently the Justice League's version of that concept doesn't involve any sort of trial by jury or anything. Straight off to execution. Still not satisfied, Snapper Carr asks about the origins of the secret sanctuary base of the Justice League, but is told that's a tale for another time. Then Snapper and fellow awful person Green Arrow, another latecomer to the show, sing happy birthday to the League, and DC Comics was promptly sued by the publishing arm of Warner Music, which is how Warner Brothers ended up owning DC Comics. But that's also a tale for another time.
Black Canary.
I'll need a sparring partner.
I'm Zatanna. What do you care about some leggy dame in nylons? Or have I answered my own question? Ladies and gentlemen, it's time for magic.
Black Canary and Zatanna. Together in one podcast. I'm Ryan Daly, and I've got a thing for superheroes in fishnet stockings. That's why I started Power of Fishnets, the Black Canary and Zatanna podcast. Join me every 2 weeks as I celebrate the blonde bombshell and the mistress of magic in their exciting adventures published by DC Comics. Power of Fishnets, available on iTunes and at fireandwaterpodcast.com.
Gardner Fox was the creator of the first major superhero group, the Justice Society of America. And one element that the JSA and Fox's Justice League of America have in common is that neither team got an origin when they first got started. A big difference, though, is that by the Silver Age, the nerds who were still reading comics were more aggressive letter hacks and were probably beating down Julie Schwartz's door asking how these heroes got together in the first place. Justice League of America number 1 sold something along the lines of 1 million copies, but by issue number 9 they were down to 335,000 copies, so Julie probably wanted to make some kids happy. The problem is this sucky origin reads like a ninth issue. The Chitauri are pretty lame threats, they're just nature-based creatures. The heroes don't have that hard of a time beating them and they're not that engaging. And then the formula of having a spotlight moment for each of the heroes to show their powers and weaknesses, that would have actually worked pretty well for a first issue if you're trying to introduce these characters. And that would have been a handy thing, I expect, in Brave and the Bold number 28, because Green Lantern had literally only had like 3 adventures before his first Justice League appearance. The Flash had only been around for about a dozen adventures or so. The Martian Manhunter had only been seen as a backup in Detective Comics. Given their newness and relative lack of visibility, getting introduced to these heroes in the first issue would have been smart. In the ninth issue, when we've already had a bunch of adventures with them, we know who they are, we know what they can do, it feels very flat, especially because there's a lack of interaction between the heroes. Because each hero gets their own individual story, the Justice League don't actually interact with one another until they're bopping up against each other in wood form, which doesn't give them much of an opportunity to display their personalities such as they were in 1959. And it just doesn't look good for 5 heroes in a row to get defeated by that one stupid wood Chitauri. You'd think at least one of them would have stopped and gone, wait, what's going on here? And it was a lucky break that it was the Martian Manhunter as the first one to fall instead of one of the latter ones, since he would have all those vision powers, so he'd been able to see what was going on well in advance of getting caught himself. But it makes the heroes look rather lame, and the villains aren't very inspiring. I think that's one of the reasons why not too many people are clamoring for the Chitauri to appear in the Justice League movie. If you go to a message board or something, you're more likely to see if people want the Chitauri in the first Justice League movie, it's probably because they want them to be sort of like the alien invaders from the first Avengers movie, where you focus on the heroes and the aliens are just the guys that the heroes are fighting. You don't want to spend a bunch of time with them. In fact, the Chitauri are so uninteresting, I wonder if you noticed that I started calling the Appalachians by the name of the aliens from the Avengers movie ever since the last promo break. And another thing, Superman and Batman get shoehorned into the final pages of the adventure. They're not part of the quintet that have to work together and form a team. And as such, they're never defeated either. It makes you think that that was editorial stepping in. You can't have Superman get beaten. You can't have Batman get beaten. And only the world's finest duo are able to help each other. We don't want these other guys to come in and make our guys, the big heroes, the name brand, look bad. Which gets me to another point I want to make. At the time the Justice League of America were created, we didn't have Earth 1, Earth 2 yet. So there was no explanation for why the Justice Society of America wasn't around anymore. And of course, it'd be quite a few years later before it was revealed that they were disbanded by the House Un-American Activities Commission. So at the time the Justice League of America were created, A fan could reasonably expect that the Justice Society and the Justice League existed on the same world, and there wasn't that big of a gap between their adventures. The JSA were gone for about 8 years before the JLA showed up. So in 1959, before all the retcons and the no prizes, I wonder what kind of rationales fans came up with for why there hadn't been a super team in that 8 year span. And my thinking is it's clearly not Wonder Woman's fault, because she debuted in All-Star Comics number 8 as a preview feature in the back of a Justice Society's book. They'd only been around for a few months prior to that. Then she went on to her own series, Sensation Comics number 1, which debuted future JSAers, Mr. Terrific and Wildcat. Wonder Woman herself joined in All-Star Comics number 11, just 3 issues after her debut, and she stayed for the most part until their very last adventure in 1951's All-Star Comics number 57. So Wonder Woman was clearly a team player. So you might point out that the Justice Society of America, their main players had retired by that point. They weren't appearing in adventures, but DC heroes were still active. Superman, Batman, and Robin, as a trio, were all hanging out together in World's Finest Comics. And Wonder Woman was active that entire time, but she never appeared in World's Finest Comics until issue number 244 in 1977. You know who was in World's Finest Comics quite a bit, though? Green Arrow. And Green Arrow joined the Seven Soldiers of Victory pretty early on in his career. But Batman, Robin, and Superman wouldn't let Green Arrow on any covers that they appeared on. They swapped out all the time, or Johnny Quick got a cover. So clearly, Green Arrow would have loved to have hung out with those guys. He's in the same book, they just won't let him in the club. Then you look at poor Aquaman in More Fun Comics. That guy couldn't get a team-up or cover until the Justice League came along. He was snubbed by the Sandman, Hourman, Starman, Manhunter, even Superboy. Aquaman couldn't even get into the Seven Soldiers of Victory, and he was created by the same guy as Green Arrow and the guy who created the Seven Soldiers. So think about it. What changed for the Justice League of America to come about? Green Lantern and the Flash were introduced and became fast friends through their initial meeting in this Justice League adventure. Only a few months prior did Martian Manhunter become openly active on Earth. Aquaman tended to be way out in the ocean for his adventures. He finally came ashore and met up with East Kindred Spirits, which gave him an excuse to have land adventures. Nothing had changed with Wonder Woman, though. She was always up for teamwork. And only a few months into the creation of the Justice League book, Green Arrow joined, because again, he's a joiner. Hell, his sidekick is even a joiner. Speedy tried to get into the Titans as early as issue number 4. He had to keep coming back and retrying until he finally got a spot in the late teens. So why wasn't there a super team between the Justice Society and the Justice League? There was. Superman, Batman, and Robin, and they weren't letting anybody else into the club. They were the same jerks then that they were in Justice League's early adventures, where they wouldn't participate with the rest of the team, and that's why the JLA is a quintet, and those other guys are cliquish douche nozzles.
Autumn, Argus, Autumn, Ballistic, Cardinal Sin, Channelman, Chimera, Edge, Freight Train, Geist, Gunfire, Acrap, Harry Force, Hitman, Hook, Jam, Joe Public, Loria, Crack, Layla, Lionheart, Loose Cannon, Megabiter, Mongolite, Myriad, Nightblade, Output, Pass, Prism, Razor Shark, Rodney Jane, Samaritan, Shadow Strike, Slingshot, Smart Shot, Terror Smith.
Wow, that's a lot of radical trademark names. And you may not have heard of any of them, but they were all introduced in DC Comics' 1993 summer annuals. Most went on to figure into more stories within their four-color universe. Many earned their own spotlight series, and one became a cult hit from acclaimed creators. While the comics of the 1990s are often derided, for me, as a longtime comic book reader, I found a deepened fandom and a safe harbor from the Chromium Age in the DCU. I fell in love with the history and legacy found in generations of heroic mantles, and my journey into this continuity largely began with Bloodlines. Join me, Diablo Frank, as I explore the more overlooked areas of DC Comics' superheroes, beginning with an early 90s intellectual property generating stunt and fanning outward towards other obscurities and icons, from throughout decades of sequential art stories, all flowing through the DC bloodlines.
Podcasts available on iTunes, Shout Engine, and the Internet Archive.
As you may have already guessed, I vastly prefer the 1988 Secret Origins revision of this contrived origin story over the original version. The characterization's better, the dialogue, it's just more fun overall, but it's still not a great story. It's just the best you can do if you're going to remain faithful to Gardner Fox's original attempt at an origin story. My main problem with the revision is the loss of Wonder Woman, where I think the League is stronger and more interesting without Superman and Batman. A big part of what makes Wonder Woman an iconic heroine is her association with the JSA and JLA. But I also understand why specifically in 1988 that had to happen, because when George Perez revised the character, nobody else wanted to do her, and nobody else could have gotten her the attention that Perez managed to get her, except maybe John Byrne. Perez was telling a very specific story with Princess Diana. It was not just her origin, but also her introduction to man's world and the contrasting between Diana's upbringing and lifestyle and that of the outside world. Perez starts that story in 101 number one, and it continues throughout his five-year run. So there's no way you could have just jumped a few years into the story without it completely demolishing what Perez was attempting to do. So that necessitated a replacement. The one heroine I can think of that wouldn't have messed up the flavor of the Justice League and might have actually been better than Black Canary was Hawkgirl, which was also the heroine chosen to be the second female in the animated Justice League series. The problem with that, though, is that Hawkgirl ultimately is still a derivative character. Hawkman came first. And so I prefer a heroine that is self-contained, that isn't a derivation of a male hero, to replace Wonder Woman. And also that would mean that Hawkgirl would have been inducted before Hawkman, and I think the men's rights activists would have rioted, so best not to test their fury or whatever. I prefer that Black Canary come up in time as well, because you got to remember in the original comics, Canary was the 11th member of the team, but only the second woman in 74 issues. That's just ridiculous. That can't stand in 2016. I don't see any reason why you can't have Wonder Woman and Black Canary on the team. It could work very similarly to the way that Batman and Superman were involved with those early Justice League adventures. Sometimes the Justice League just got involved in more mundane activities, and Black Canary could have been, say, an eighth member or an earlier joiner than Green Arrow. I don't think anybody would be too bent out of shape about Green Arrow getting pushed back one notch. She could be in some of the adventures, Wonder Woman could be in some of the other adventures. And I actually think it'd be interesting if Black Canary replaced Wonder Woman in another role. During the time period where Wonder Woman had to leave the Justice League because she forsook her Amazonian powers and became a normal mortal woman. And then she became sort of a globe-trotting Diana Peele-style adventure heroine with her new Asian martial arts master, Ai Ching. I really enjoyed those Diana Prince stories, but it's very hard to make that work for Wonder Woman in a modern context, and it was very problematic even in the 1960s. A lot of feminists took issue with that depowering of Wonder Woman, taking away one of their only really powerful superheroine icons. But it strikes me that Black Canary, who could use development and use a greater solo-style history, could absorb that part of Wonder Woman's history. She could be the Mad Maud karate-kicking heroine without it making any major changes to her. Maybe she loses her canary cry for a while, she goes off and has her adventures, and then she could still come back in the same story, roughly, that she originally debuted as a Justice League member in issue 74 through 75. She got her canary cry back, she's back on the team. I think Wonder Woman would be perfectly fine with sacrificing a little bit of her history that's problematic anyway to further empower another heroine. And I'm about the biggest fan of the Diana Prince Wonder Woman comic books as you're going to find, and I'm cool with that. It seems to me like everybody wins under those circumstances. But you might cry foul because why are we doing another revision? Why must we always dip into retroactive continuity? And my argument would be that the Justice League origin was a retcon to begin with. And I strongly suspect that a lot of the people who were reading Justice League at the time JLA number 9 came out probably had their own ideas of what the Justice League's origin would have been. And given what a mediocre story it was, they probably had better stories in mind. And I suspect that's why, more than probably any other major superhero team, the origin of the Justice League is the least immutable. You can change it. You can do revisions on it. Creed has been doing it from very early on, before retcon was really even part of the lexicon of comics. And I think that many of those revisions are a lot better than this original story. And in fact, that first major revision is my favorite Justice League origin of all time. So I look forward to covering that one in the next installment of JL May Day One, which will appear on the next episode of the Idlehead of Diablo podcast. But of course, this is just a supplementation of JL May, a podcast crossover event covering the JLA Year One miniseries. And the first participating podcast, Fire and Water episode 163, is already out, covering JLA Year One numbers 1 through 2. And this Friday, Power of Fishnets episode number 6 will pick up from there. So I hope you'll take advantage to try a whole bunch of different flavors of Justice League love, and we'll catch you next time.
Your ego betrays you. Will you not listen to reason? This won't end well for you.
We received retweets from Alan Middleton, Ange, The Anti-Fascist, Between the Pages, Keith G. Baker, Mark Sweeney, Ryan C. at Trash Film Guru, and Siskoid, and favorites from Inigo Montoya, Illegal Machine, Illit Records, It's Plastic Man, Carl Disley, Longbox Graveyard, Marty Light, Michael Bailey Podcasts, The Power of Fishnets Podcast, its host Ryan Daly, and Scott Bachman. Folks who did both, the Maniacs from Mars, include the 108th Sage, Cash Flag, Charlton Hero, Coffee and Comics Blog, Comic Reflections, Darren and Ruth Sutherland, Dr. G. Nerdologist, Ed Moore at Teal Productions, Fantastiverse, Glenn Walker, Jacob Edwards, Joseph Crawford, Cord Industries, King Size Comics Giant Size Fun Podcast, Kyle Pettit, Luke Dobwalker, Max Romero, Michael Wagner, Mr. Morbid, Not Guano Man, Odyssey Unleashed Podcast, Oscar Blue Devil, Randy Caldwell, Richard Field, Scott Bachman, Son of Cthulhu, Synod Alias Scarecrow, Trekker Talk Podcast, and Warlord Worlds Podcast, as well as Follow Fridays and Tweet Heroes from Comic Reflections and Scott Bachman. And Warlord Worlds noted us as a great blog for your Martian Manhunter content, alongside Dr. Anja's Supergirl Comic Box commentary and Son of Cthulhu's comics and H.P. Lovecraft. The Anti-Fascist asked, did you see our recent post on Justice League Task Force number 7-8 over at The Unspoken Decade? All about your man, Martian Manhunter, bro. At Calmodore did a great job. And I read it, and I did enjoy it. Cash Flag wrote, working my way through Idlehead Podcast, really good stuff. Martin Gray wrote of episode 19, enjoyed the new show loads. I really have to commend you on your voices. They're the dog's bollocks. While I hate the idea of John as a weapon, I've gotten used to the setup of the current series and I'm enjoying it. It's so ruddy bonkers. I'm sure a classic John will return with the coming DC rebirth. Meanwhile, I do enjoy some of the alternate identities. It's an interesting spin on Ostrander's John with his multiple secret identities around the globe. No cat, though. Luke Dobwalker wrote, Dude! I finally caught up on episode 20 of the Martian Manhunter podcast. So freaking good, man. Such love. If you haven't heard Frank's two-part 60th anniversary of the Martian Manhunter podcast, you're missing out. It happened that the second part of the Martian Manhunter 60th anniversary podcast came in between a new episode of the Fire and Water Network's Who's Who podcast and the return from a lengthy hiatus of the Secret Origins podcast. So I made the crack that this show was going to be like The Flash against Cosby and The Simpsons back in the 90s. And wrote, you mean the cool kids will listen to it first? Thanks for that. Nicholas Prom of Comic Reflections wrote, hi Frank. A couple days ago, I tuned into the latest episode of The Idlehead, my first. I like what you're doing, and you've certainly gotten me more interested in a character I have traditionally been fairly unenthused about. Glad to hear it. That's part of the point. Kyle Pettit wrote, great episode. Great to hear the opinions of Kyle Rayner and Wally West. Finally, Count Druncula wrote, pat yourself on the back, Frank, or do whatever it is you do when you feel a sense of pride and accomplishment. Cigar, champagne, shoe shopping binge. The hard work, time, and dedication you poured into John Jones' 60th anniversary yielded four of the best hours of podcasting I can recall. The value of the audio clips and the diversity of voices, both archival and digitized, kept this Martian Love Fest from ever feeling boring. It's fascinating how many talented people love the Martian Manhunter and want to tell stories with him, but few, if any, make lasting impressions outside of the devoted superhero fandom.
And remember, podcast coverage goes from here over to our buddy Ryan Daly over at Power of Fishnets. Then after that, it goes to Waiting for Doom, then to the Lantern Cast, then to Supermates, then to the Idlehead of Diablo. then to Comic Reflections, then to Views from the Long Box to finish it out. And all of them will be done by the end of May. It is J.L. May.
Podcast listeners should feel free to leave a comment on one of our blogs, either the Umbrella Rolled Spine Podcasts or the specific Idlehead of Diablo blog. Both are available quite easily through Google searches. You can also shoot me a tweet at Commander Blanks. That's B-L-A-N-X. Thank you for listening.